Okay, we're ready now. Good evening. I almost did not make it tonight. I was telling Alex that I had a good nap, and I slept right through my alarm, and but I did make it. So I'm thankful that all of you made it as well, and that we can be here tonight together to worship our God, and also to go to his good book and read more about what he has for us in here. We're going to be looking at Psalm 90 this evening, Psalm 90. And I'm going to start out just reading the psalm through, and then we'll go back and talk about it. Psalm 90 begins book 4. Lord, you have been, it says, a prayer of Moses, the man of God. Lord, you have been our dwelling place from generation to generation. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man back into dust, and say, return, O sons of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. You have swept them away like a flood, they fall asleep. In the morning they are like grass, which sprouts anew. In the morning it blossoms and sprouts anew. Toward evening it withers away and dries up. For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we have been dismayed. You have set out our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days have declined in your fury. We have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to might, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and wickedness. For soon it is gone, and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? So teach us to number our days, that we might present to you a heart of wisdom. Return, O Yahweh, how long will it be? And be sorry for your slaves. O satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days you have afflicted us and the years we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your slaves and your majesty to your sons. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish us and establish for us the work of our hands. Establish the work of our hands. So Psalm 90 begins with a subtitle in Psalm 2. Too earlier this morning, we talked about the subtitles. Are they subtitles? They're titles beneath the psalm. But many times they'll have some kind of information about the psalm. Many of the psalms, for example, in book 1 and book 2 are going to be psalms that are by David. And that's helpful information. So as we're sometimes these subtitles will also include historical notes about either when this psalm was written or what was David considering, at least, when he was writing this psalm. And that's helpful as you go through the psalms to consider, oh yes, there's a connection to be made here. Here it has a subtitle of great interest. It says, A Prayer of Moses. Now, of course, scholars are going to make fun of this idea, thinking that how is it that this psalm could be belong to Moses, who lived some 1,000 years before the psalms were finally compiled. How is it that this psalm so ancient can be part of this text now? However, I think it is useful to think that while maybe these subtitles are not maybe inspired, as in these were written down immediately when the psalmist himself is writing these things down, but they are definitely part of the compilation of these psalms, and I think that portion is definitely inspired. But these psalms, when this is written down, it is interesting to think or interesting to consider that many of the words here, and we're not going to go through all of these verses, but I just suggest that you take some time to look at Psalm 90 and also look at the songs of Moses in Deuteronomy 32 and Deuteronomy 33. That a lot of the words, the last words of Moses, there's a lot of ideas and a lot of words that are particularly parallel to this text. So I don't think that it's a stretch at all to think that here is a very ancient psalm that now, it is now included then in this book of Psalms. And if that is the case, then it's the most, it's the oldest psalm that we have in the Bible. Here is Moses including this psalm to help us to understand these things. This psalm is going to have three parts, and you can see the three parts over here on the left-hand side. The first six verses are going to talk about the contrast between God and man. We'll see that in just a minute. In verses 7 through 11, we're going to talk about this life that is tainted by sin and the suffering that we have to go through because of sin and because of the difficulties caused by sin. Verses 12 through 17 then comes back and says, Lord, make sense of life. Give us purpose in all of this. What's going on? That's how I divide up Psalm 90. So looking at this, look at verses 1 and 2 with me, and look at the descriptions that he gives of God. It says in verse 1, Lord, you have become our dwelling place from generation to generation. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the void, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So Psalm 90, verses 1 through 2, give us a description of God. I think it is useful for us to just look and take time to consider the names that it uses, the descriptions that it gives for God in these passages. In fact, the book of Psalms generally do not just haphazardly choose certain descriptors of God, but they painstakingly choose certain names or certain descriptions. Just as a note, and again, sometime when you are have your own time, in Psalms 1, the first book of the book of Psalms focuses primarily on the word. The word Lord or the word Yahweh is the personal name of God. So Psalms 1 through 41, if you just look there and count the number of times, I don't suggest you count that manually, get a computer software and do that, but you count the number of times that it uses the name Yahweh versus the name, just the general term of God, and it is amazing how many times you find the word Yahweh instead of God, the more general term of Elohim. You get to book 2, however, and it's flipped. In other words, the writers of the Psalms and the compiler of the Psalms is choosing these Psalms sometimes based maybe solely on it uses this term for God instead of this other term. And so in other words, the terms that are used to talk about God are very purposeful. And so in this verse, how does he talk about God? So, for example, in verse 1, he says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place. Lord, you have been our dwelling place. He first says that he is Lord. He is Lord. The name Lord that is here, many times in our Bibles, we have two different words for Lord. Many times in our Bibles, for example, you'll have the word Lord in all caps. Have you seen that before? In all caps. So, for example, in verse 13, return, O Lord. In many of your versions, will say, return, O Lord. In my version here, it says, return, O Yahweh. There's a Jewish tradition, and I won't get into the Jewish tradition now, but there's this Jewish tradition that because of that, our modern-day publishers then choose, instead of to translate this as as this term or another term, they've chosen to translate it as Lord in all caps. That's the personal name of God. However, here in verse 1, that's not the personal name of God. It's a reference to God as Master. And so understanding that gives us an idea of which way should we go with this. Master. He is the one who is in control. So apart from just being something that's interesting, many times these choices in how we describe God give us an understanding of the significance of the text. And so in this psalm, he begins with directing himself to God as Lord. This is Lord as a title, as master, the master of creation, the master of the world, the king of the universe. Everything is under his control. I like to think then, if this is a psalm written by Moses, to think of Moses being a witness of God's power, him being a witness of God as Lord. Just think of all of the things that God, that Moses has witnessed as he's gone throughout his life. The 10 plagues, a burning bush, crossing over the Red Sea, God displaying his control and his might in a way that we've never seen before. He says, God, you are Lord. But not only is he Lord, he is also, in verse 1, he is our dwelling place. He is our refuge. The word dwelling place can be described or translated as home or refuge or shelter. Usually the word is spoken in the Old Testament about the place where God dwells. So God dwells in the heavens, for example. God dwells in his temple among his people, which is an amazing thought to be meditated on. But the thought that is here is God being our refuge. That is where we go to hide. That's where we go to live and dwell. Again, thinking of Moses and thinking of his life is impressive to me. If Moses is writing this psalm, and it seems like he's writing this psalm in maybe the last 40 years of his life, where has been Moses' home physically? Well, maybe for the last 40 years, he's been doing what? Wandering through the wilderness. He's not had... Could you imagine that? We get used to where we live very, very quickly. I've put my stuff up, and I got my stuff in my hotel. I put my coats over here. I put my pets over here. And okay, I got my home. But I'm going to move on. And that was the story of all of the Israelites for 40 years. Could you imagine that? For 40 years, you're camping and not having a single place to call home, to plant a garden, to build a wall, to build a garage. You are a pilgrim, as a nomad of the desert. But even though he had no single home, before he goes to the even though he has no single home, he wasn't even going to be able to look forward to going to the land of promise. So it's not just that he's, okay, I'm going to have to move and move and move, and then, but one day I'm going to get to a place where I'm going to call that home. God said, Moses, no. You're not going to even make it to the promised land. However, in this psalm, even though he has no home physically, he says that with each step that he takes, it is the master who is his refuge. It is the master who is his home. He is the comfort of protection in all his days. This is a refuge that is greater than anything that we can think of. In fact, it is a refuge greater, so much greater, that he says it's not just his refuge, but it says in verse 1, a refuge from generation to generation. And so whose refuge is this? Well, God is my refuge. That's my home. That's where I find security. But then he looks back at generations gone by. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, as the writer of Hebrews points out, that these are individuals who didn't see these promises fulfilled. That they were people that were looking for a city made without hands. They were looking for something greater. And so here is Moses. He's doing the same thing. He was the refuge, though, of all of the generations gone past. But even more than that, he says, here is this master, this Lord, who was there even before the mountains were made. He was there before the earth and the world were brought forth. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. It is difficult for me to think of long periods of time. I've only lived one lifetime, right? Maybe, hopefully half a lifetime. I haven't lived very long, and so I can't contemplate, 100 years? That's hard for me to think of. 200 years? 1,000 years? I can give you dates. I can give you things that happened 1,000 years ago. 2,000 years? 3,000? It's hard for my mind to even wrap around this idea, this great passage of time. How is that even possible? It's helpful for me, though, to think of places that have been witness to the lives of individuals time and time again. For example, the city of Jerusalem. Maybe you can picture Jerusalem in your mind's eye. Even the modern city of Jerusalem. And think about how many events passed in this one place of Jerusalem. How many generations, starting even with people who were before David, but then David comes, and then king after king reigns and dies, and reigns and dies, and reigns and dies. How many people came and left this one mountain? How many kings governed over this one hill? How many armies came and entered in to its walls? How many people lived and died and worked and played? But there in the midst of all of these generations, there is this mountain. It's the same mountain. But it is God, the Lord, who made the mountain. So however great we feel like these mountains are, that are witness to all of our folly, it is God who made it all. From eternity to eternity, you are God. He is the great I am. He is the Lord. He is our only refuge. In verse 3, he then begins to contemplate the opposite. He looks at us and sees that while God is eternal, he then thinks about man and thinks about how brief his life is. He says in verse 3, you turn man back into dust. And you say, return, O sons of men. What does that remind you of? Returning back to dust. Genesis 3, verse 19. Where he talks about the idea that because of sin, Adam would have to return to dust. In verse 4, 1,000 years are in your sight, or in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. What does that remind you of? It seems like Peter quotes from this, or at least the idea in 2 Peter chapter 3. In verse 8, you're familiar with a verse where it talks about that one day is like 1,000 years to the Lord, and 1,000 years is like one day. God does not work on the same clock that we do. And so the idea comes from here. But the psalmist here, Moses, goes even further than 2 Peter. He says that 1,000 years are like what? It's like a night that passes by, or a day that passes by. It's like yesterday, or like a watch in the night. What's a watch in the night? It's like one of those three-hour periods. It's brief. It's just brief. It's not so that we can calculate exactly how... You get the idea. It's talking about God's eternal nature, but then what is our life like? Our life is just a blink of the eye. And so when he looks in verse 5, you have swept them away like a flood. You swept our years away like a flood. You have swept man away like a flood, and they fall asleep. In the morning, they are like the grass, which sprouts anew. In the morning, it blossoms, and it sprouts anew. Toward evening, it withers away, and it dries up. Moses is contemplating the brevity of life, how we are but just a simple drop in this river of time. Only a piece of sand in this hourglass. And then we're gone. We have our brief moment as we go over the brink. And there we are. But then we're no longer there. We bloom for a brief moment, but then as the grass blooms, it then also withers away and dries up. How long do you think that you will live? This psalm is absolutely great for us to be asking that question, isn't it? How long do you think that you will live? If we're going to think about maybe the lifestyle that we live today, I don't know, what would people guess? Maybe we'll live 80 years, as it's written here in the psalm. Maybe 95 years? Well, that's a long time. But in comparison with eternity, that's nothing. Even Moses' life, where he lived, what, 120 years? Is nothing in comparison with eternity, just a blink of the eye. I am 43 years old. And I'm thoughtful of the fact that since I have 43 years, and if I calculate right, and if God gives me the years, maybe I'll live to be about 80. Who knows? But if I live to be about 80, what does that mean about my life? That means that the half of my life is gone. Gone. It doesn't seem like 43 years. It seems like it was a day. But it's gone. Whether I spent it well or I wasted it, it doesn't matter. It's gone. And now I'm thinking about the next 43, 33, 23, however many years God gives to me. It will come and it will go. And I will be gone. I'll be gone and I will be forgotten. We like to think that we will be remembered, right? I would like to think that my children love me enough that they'll remember me for a while, right? Maybe I'll even have grandchildren. If God blesses me with grandchildren, they'll remember my personality. They'll remember my name. But what about my great-grandchildren? Will they even remember what color eyes I have? What about my great-great-grandchildren? Just a few generations later, I'll just be one name in a list of individuals who have come, who have gone, and have disappeared. The brevity of life gives us a lot to consider. We don't often do that, but we need to. Especially when we see the notes at the end of this psalm. But before we do that, look with me in verse 7. Because in verse 7, Moses is going to talk about the fact that it is not just because we are suffering or we are dying and we are briefly here. That's not just the only thing that causes him to think. But it's also, in verse 7, he talks about that our life is filled with pain and suffering because of the wrath of God. Notice again his words here in verse 7. We have been consumed by your anger. And by your wrath, we have been dismayed. We have set our iniquities before you, have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days have declined in your fury, and we have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to might, 80 years. But their pride is but labor and wickedness, for soon it is gone and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? What does he say? He says that not only does he contemplating the brevity of life, but Moses is also worried and thoughtful of the pain and the suffering that he has to go through because of the wrath of God that is upon him. It is with agony that he says, "We have been consumed by your wrath, by your anger. We have been dismayed." What is Moses talking about? Is this an appropriate way to look at life? To say that all day long I'm being consumed by your anger? I think it's helpful to think again about Moses' circumstance. Moses is traveling for 40 years, and what is happening to the people of Israel? Well, basically, these 40 years, you remember the reason why they have to travel around for 40 years in the wilderness. Before those 40 years, God had said, "Go in to the land of promise. It's yours for the taking." But they said, "What? We don't think we can do it. We can't do it, even with God on our side. We are but grasshoppers before these giants. We can't do it. Don't make us go in there." And so God says, "Okay. According to the days that you are in Canaan, now you are going to march around each day. For every day, you're going to march 1 year there in the wilderness." And so 40 years, and that generation was going to die in the wilderness. And so what we have in the book of Numbers after that is a story, a very sad story, how God basically is watching the death of his people throughout the whole story. Thousands die on this occasion. Thousands die on that occasion. And when we finally get to the end of the book of Numbers, finally we renumber the people, and we again have a people ready to go into the land of promise. But thinking about that time period, could you imagine how painful that would be for Moses? This is not just, well, those sinners over there, how they are. Yes, they did sin. But these are the brethren of Moses, right? These are brothers and sisters, family members who are just dying before Moses there in the desert. And Moses knows that it is because of God's wrath, God's anger, God's punishment upon them that they're having to see all of this through. But it doesn't take all the pain away. Let God's will be done, but it still hurts. I think there's a lot of application in all of this. As we consider this in a very general way, that we can relate to the suffering of Moses as we see our own suffering in this life. Because we can relate to the fact that many times my suffering in this life is the result of my own sin. I sin, I'm stupid, and the result is suffering. But not only is there suffering as a result of my own sin, that many times there is suffering as the result of my neighbor's sin, my father's sin. In fact, as we look at this world generally, and the suffering that is going on in this world, whether it be the suffering that is due because of cancer, the suffering that is the result of COVID, the suffering that is a result of growing old and dying, in reality, is that not the result of sin? Not necessarily my own personal sin, but we live in a world that is corrupt and tainted by sin. We don't live in Eden anymore. And each one of us has a mental reminder every day when we look in the mirror and we see gray hairs appearing more and more. I won't get into all the changes. But those reminders are reminders that we live in a sinful world and that I have been part of that. But it doesn't take all the pain away. I could live with it, you know, if it's just me that I have to deal with my own sin. But I also have to see the suffering in my loved ones. The death in my of my grandparents. Or our babies who are innocent. I can think about it and understand it, but it doesn't take all the pain away. And so with the psalmist, we are left wondering, why? What's the purpose of all of this? Why would God allow all of this? It reminds me, this psalm reminds me so much of the message of Ecclesiastes. You remember the book of Ecclesiastes, especially in chapter 12, where he talks about death and talks about the idea of coming to face your maker. Go over to Ecclesiastes, chapter 12. He says in verse 1, "Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth before the evil days happen, and the years draw near in which you say, 'I have no delight in them.' Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. In the day when the watchmen of the house tremble and the valiant men bend down and the grinding ones stand idle because they are few. And those who look through the windows grow dark and the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low. And one will arise at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. Furthermore, the men are afraid of high places and terrors on the road. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and the caperberry is ineffective. For man goes to his eternal home, but the mourners go about in the streets. Remember him, therefore, before the silver cord is snapped, and the golden bowl is crushed, the pitcher by the spring is broken, and the wheel of the cistern is crushed. Then dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity." If all we are contemplating is the brevity of life, the life under the sun, which is the context of Ecclesiastes as well, if all we're contemplating is the times that we have to suffer and then we're dead, what is the purpose of life? How can God help us with this? So in verse 12, we are given some things to think about here. In verse 12, there are four things I see that Moses makes as a petition to God. He says in verse 12, he says, "So teach us to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom." Teach us to number our days. It's not the idea that I'm going to take a calendar and mark off every single day. Maybe that's a good thing to do. But numbering our days, being thoughtful that our days are few, helps us to understand that I need to use these few days and use them for the Lord. And it helps us to be wise about how we spend our time. You know, anything that's limited, if I give you a credit card and say, "Hey, go buy yourself some lunch." Okay, go buy myself some lunch. You might get get the extra big burger from Burger King and put bacon on it and get three towers. And wow, he gave me a credit card. I don't know how much I'm supposed to spend. I can spend all I want. So you take advantage of it, right? There's no limit. But when we understand, I give you $5. Oh no. What am I going to do? What am I going to do now? I'm going to have to make sure that I have enough to pay for lunch with those $5. And so if I buy this, that's going to make sure. You get the idea. Anytime there's a limit to any type of resource, we start to use it more wisely. And if we start to think about our life in that same way, I don't have forever here. I'm also going to spend my life thinking about how am I going to use this day, and I'm going to use it more wisely. Reminds me of the words of Paul in Ephesians chapter 5. It may be that even Paul had in mind Psalm 90 when he's writing these things. But in Ephesians chapter 5, he says in verse 15, "Therefore, look carefully how you walk, not as the unwise, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. On account of this, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is." What is Paul's advice? Understand that we do not have eternity here on earth. We are here for just a moment, and what's the purpose of our life? It's going to be suffering, it's going to be hard, it's going to be just a moment. How am I going to use it? Redeem the time. Buy back the time. Use it for good. Use it for the glory of God. With wisdom, by numbering our days, we can have wisdom. Wisdom can help us further avoid suffering. But even greater, wisdom will give us purpose, how we are going to use this life appropriately. In verse 13, he says, "Return, O Yahweh, how long will it be? And be sorry for your slaves." In verse 13, he says, "Return, O Yahweh." Your version may say, repent instead of return. But there is a play on words here in verse 13 with what he said in verse 3. In verse 3, it had said, "You turn men back into dust and say, return, sons of men." God is calling people through death unto him. You're going to have to come back. But even while we are here in our suffering, what are we calling to God for? We call out to God. God, come to us so that you can be our refuge even during this time of trouble. While men are turning into dust, the psalmist pleads with God to return to our dismal situation. How long will we have to endure this misery? Give us relief. Christians are susceptible to the same pains that everyone in the world is. But we have a refuge that keeps us strong. We have a rock to which we can turn. We have a purpose in this life, however brief it may be. And then in verse 16, he calls on God to work and let his works appear among us. He says in verse 14, "Oh, satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days that you have afflicted us and the years that we have seen your evil. Let your work appear to your slaves and your majesty to your sons." What is he asking from God? Seems like he's asking for just a little bit of reprieve, for a little bit of relief from all of this. It is easy for us when we think about the brevity of life and the suffering that we have to go through, and the suffering that is because of sin, the suffering that it is easy to look at life and say, "What's the purpose?" Right? Why do I have to go through all of this? But can't we be thankful that even in the darkest of times, God is blessing his children. Amen. And God is giving them exactly what they need. Even Paul, as he's sitting there in a prison, wasting his time, one might think. Paul's the Apostle Paul. He ought to be out, you know, running around and meeting people and teaching people. And how much of his life now as the apostle is he stuck in prison? Paul uses that time from our perspective as one of the most productive times ever. Isn't that amazing? He uses that for God's glory. He blesses Paul even during those times of reminders of his brethren. He calls on God to be a refuge. I like what he says then in verse 17, finally. He says, then let the favor of the Lord your God, Lord our God, the Master our God, be upon us and establish for us the work of our hands. Establish the work of our hands. So it's interesting, again, in verse 16, we're talking about the work of whom? It's the work of Yahweh, the work of God. What's he doing there in verse 16? But he's also, Moses is also thoughtful about his own work. He asks God, show your work among your people. Let us see your mighty power. Give us relief in our suffering. But then in verse 17, he says, also, take my works, my pitiful works, and make them mean something. I wonder what Moses knew about his life. I wonder what he thought might happen after he's gone and buried in the wilderness. Would anyone remember me? Would anyone ever be thoughtful of Moses? Of course, here we are thousands of years and we're still talking about Moses. We're still talking about the work that he did. It is amazing to me to think of the small things that these mere humans have done. And to be thoughtful how God has taken those mere works and has used them for something greater than Moses, greater than David, greater than Joshua, greater than any of these men. And that gives me strength as well. Because I don't know how long I'll be here. Sometimes I wonder, does anyone even remember the things that I share in the pulpit? Does anyone really remember these? I spend work on it, and then I can't even remember next week what I preached the week past. How are other people? Am I doing any good? I need not to focus on my own works, but I need to focus on the fact that God is the one who takes my life, as meaningless as it seems, and makes it into something that is beautiful, something useful for his glory. And even if no one remembers this sermon or the life of David Rafe, it is God above who remembers this tiny grain of sand. And he looks upon me, and he is my refuge. That's a powerful psalm. This is a psalm that we need even today. I hope that you have been thoughtful of your own life tonight. Thoughtful about the brevity of your life, no matter how long you have lived or how short you have lived. We are here for just a moment. The question is, what are we going to do with that brief moment? That brief beat of the heart. That brief breath in our lungs. How are we going to use that? Are we going to use it for ourselves and then die? Or are we going to seek refuge and he who gave life, and use our lives for the glory of the God who created life? I hope that we will be thoughtful about these things. Let's be thoughtful as we stand and seeing the number that was selected.